2. Okay, so I'm a guest speaker. But I'm a known guest. Because I haven't lived here in 5 years or so. More than 5 years. But I have lived here in the past for 12 years. And and as a guest speaker, I don't have to play by everybody else's rules. We have a very, very kind of important and pregnant passage, to use the term in its oldest meaning. It's just full. If you think of Old Testament passages or Torah passages that are very kind of significant, I think some that come to mind are, you know, the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, and of course the Shema in Deuteronomy 6, and maybe the priestly blessing in Numbers 6. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to come up with a more central passage in the Torah than our passage today. So what I'm going to try and do is the impossible. I shall try to get through all of the material, concentrating on the text and background and how the text has been interpreted, and also try to give some things that I think are of devotional import. But I admit at the start, I'll need help. And I don't have answers for a lot of questions, and I would be interested in your input and feedback. And so I was very happy to see Dorota last week leading this, and it looked a little bit like herding cats, but she managed to get through all of the passages, and I thought it was very impressive. So we shall try to do that. So this is the part of Leviticus that, according to kind of critical scholarship, is known as the Holiness Code. And a lot of people, not everybody, a lot of people think it's maybe even the oldest part of Leviticus. It certainly has a focus, an emphasis on holiness, and this refrain keeps being repeated: "Be holy as I am holy." So I think we'll do a little differently from what Dorotel did last time. We will not read the whole chapter all the way through at the beginning. We'll read it through section by section. And so I'll let people read, and I think maybe we'll just go around the room. So, Gemma, would you like to read the first two verses, please?
You haven't really spelled out either your name or the chapter that we're reading.
Oh, sorry. That would be good.
That would be good, I think.
So the chapter we're reading is Leviticus 19, verses 1 through 22. We shan't go beyond that because Nick is here, and he's supposed to do from 23 to the end next week, and so he won't allow me to do any of his material.
It's not his section. It's not your section anyway. It stops at 23.
Yeah, right. But there's good stuff after this.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing is my name. Yes, I'm Aaron Horncole. Nice to meet you. The first two verses.
Okay, Leviticus 19. Adonai spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to all the congregation of Bnei Israel and tell them, 'You shall be Kedoshim, for I, Adonai, your God, am holy. Each one of you is to respect his mother and his father and to keep my Shabbatot. I am Adonai, your God. Do not turn to idols or make molten gods for yourselves. I am Adonai, your God.'"
Okay. So, this translation used Kedoshim and also used holy.
Yeah, this is what's called the Tree of Life version.
Okay. So, I was interested in just, this is not the first time it's come up in these chapters from 17 to 26, where you have this emphasis on holiness, but I thought I would at least make a remark on it. This idea about being holy because I am holy. Evidently, this is not for everybody. This is for people who are in a very particular covenant relationship with God. And according to Exodus, when Bnei Israel, when the Israelites are kind of, well, they're brought out of Egypt and then they're confronted with the possibility of entering into a covenant. And if we read in Exodus 24:3, it says, "And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, and all of the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do." So it's not just a call, it's not a call, a worldwide call, anything like this. It's very specific to a people who have, in some sense, voluntarily entered into a covenant relationship with God. In some way, and I'm not sure that I fully understand this, and this is one of the times where I will ask for input. Kadosh, holy, is often explained as being set apart, being different, and in some way to be different, because it says here, as I am holy, different like God in some way. So, do you have thoughts on this? Do you have, because it's a very powerful kind of otherly image or notion.
I have very strong thoughts on it.
I imagined this.
I mean, yeah, it's set apart. And Israel is told to be set apart, just in the same way as God himself is holy, set apart, and different. And we're told that. We're not running around with halos on our heads. It's the whole nature of who we are. We're set apart very often for a specific task. I mean, you know, it's like the horses at the end of Zechariah. The horses are holy. Well, I mean, the horses aren't running around with halos on their heads. They're set apart for a particular task, whatever it happened to be in that context.
So I always have a little bit of trouble saying it's set apart as a definition. To me, holy, God is holy. That's basically the definition. Whatever you say, nothing is holy, God is holy, and everything that's related to him is holy. But I don't know if we can separate, you can be separated to do something else that's not connected God, but it's always in that connection.
So it's separated to God.
Well, I don't know why it's separated. It's just God is holy, and everything that's connected to him is holy.
I've never taken set apart to mean separate in the sense of not together. I just didn't mean other. I meant
but some. Maybe connected is a good word.
But
it's connected to God.
I mean, you can kind of say it in both. So, like, I always view the opposite of, like, the kadosh idea is heaven, you know, like set apart from something that's like bad, right? And it's normally taken like that, devoted to destruction, is what the translation is. But if you just say like it's set apart, but it's set apart like for it has some sort of like moral or element of like goodness in it, right? So then you can't say it's just set apart, right? And that's why God is the one described as chiefly holy, because it also has this element of like goodness.
So the word I heard you use that struck me was devoted.
Right. So if you say like something is, I mean, so like the articles in the temple or in the tabernacle are holy. They're devoted to a specific purpose, right? Where they're really devoted to service for something that's good. Right? And God is, I mean, obviously, it's difficult to explain then how God is holy, right? What is he devoted to, or like, what is he, how is he set apart?
I would think that if Kadosh actually is it derives from God. That's the basic kadosh. So anything devoted to God then
is also
that
right,
way.
Exactly.
This.
Yeah, I think the basic definition is that which is God.
Okay.
And then in extension, it can also apply
right,
to
right.
things and people. So that's why you get the devoted, because it's like when you apply it to people and things, it's devoted to God in that way.
So is there something?
If it's devoted or if it's just holy because it's in relationship with God. I mean, what does devoted mean? Then you have an idea of a specific task.
No, I was thinking a whole.
What's the word?
It comes from you take a vow and you become belong to kind of thing.
Yeah, committed.
Committed. From votive, from you know. Is there something in the middle? Is there something between harem and kadosh? Or
is there something between what?
Banned, profane, and
hol
and kadosh. Is there, because you said devoted to destruction.
Is that what I was translating?
Yeah, and then you said devoted to God. So is there middle ground? Is there just profane in the neutral? Not well, maybe not neutral, but it's a question. It's not.
I don't think of profane as neutral.
Well, the old meaning is neutral, non-sacred.
Oh, right.
Like a regular day.
The opposite of sacred. Sacred and profane.
Secular is
the... Yemechol, right. Right. Weekdays. With your permission or without, we're going to go on. Nick, can you please read... just verse 3 for now.
You shall each revere your mother and father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God.
So, there's something special in this verse that is what I'm looking for. There's lots of special things, but I'm looking for one special thing. What is it? This is like Bilbo Baggins' riddle. What have I got in my pocket?
Two echoes of the Ten Commandments.
Okay. One is?
The parents.
Uh-huh.
And the others keeping Shabbat.
Right. And in the Ten Commandments, where are they located? Yeah, right next to each other. In the opposite order, but next to each other. So yes, that's an important thing. And by the way, this we will see echoes of, not echoes of, I don't want to say echoes, it's like the Ten Commandments are first and this is second. We will see parallels to the Ten Commandments in this section. This is also the... Well, one of two times actually. There's 21 times in the Bible where you get the order Av v'em, father and mother, and there's only twice here and one chapter later where you get the mother first. And the rabbis were it was not lost on them this difference. And one of the things they did was compare this verse to the Ten Commandments, and in the Ten Commandments. The verb used is to honor your father and mother. And it's, maybe you know the word kavod, so it's the verb related to that, kavod, honor, glory. And in this verse, it's fear. And the rabbis distinguished between fear and honor. And fear, they said, was what kept you from doing bad things. And honor is what makes you do good things. Now, that's a very rabbinic way of explaining things. I don't say it's a wrong way, but it's a very typically rabbinic way to do it. And then, on that basis, they came up with an explanation for why mother is here first and why father is first in the Ten Commandments. And the idea is you are more likely to fear your father. That is to be afraid of doing things wrong, and in his case, and so here, mother is put forward because you need to also fear her. And in the Ten Commandments, you're more likely, evidently, to do good things for your mother actively, and so their father is put first. So that might be simplistic. But or it might be, maybe it's perfectly fine. But it is a way that people have been trying to deal with the text for a very long time, and trying to deal with the details in the text. So I don't say that that necessarily is the answer, but it is an answer. Does anybody want to add anything more on verse 3?
So the word that we've got here is respect, is actually fear?
Yeah, it's the verb...
Because fear... What's the word in Hebrew for fear?
Yare.
Yare.
Like fear of the
Lord.
Yeah, yeah. Yare. I was just trying to think, because yare means a lot more than being afraid of.
Yes.
It's a very strange way of understanding it, that you're going to be more afraid of, in this case. Yeah.
I mean, I have family from Scotland, Clan Munro, and we have a, what do you call it, a plaque, coat of arms, and it has an ugly, rather ugly looking plaid, and and it has a motto.
Fear the Lord.
Dread God.
Oh, dread God.
And I think that's in its day, that was a way of saying respect and be sufficiently fearful of God. Today it sounds rather
it's a fearful
severe
thing to fall into the hands of the living God.
Yeah. Shall we go on then to verse? Anybody, anything else? Though don't feel rushed. I mean, don't feel rushed, but please hurry. Okay, verse 4. Turn.
Do not turn to idols or make cast images for yourselves. I am the Lord your God.
So I think this reminds us again. It's also found in the Ten Commandments. There's always a question here about whether, I mean, I think I automatically think in ancient terms of multiplicity of deities, worshipping other gods. It is not, however, impossible that this is actually referring to making images associated with Israel's God. It's not necessarily an anti-polytheistic thing. It could be an anti-iconic rule.
What sort of images did people make?
Well, there was a golden calf.
Oh, right.
Which they call Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Yeah. Right.
The first part was do not turn to Elohim. Yeah. That would include other gods, right?
Yeah. Not sure. Is it automatically? Does the word Elil, is it actually a god, or is it the image of?
It's an idol, isn't it?
But it's plural.
But every word for God is plural.
No.
If you say Elohim Masecha, that can be one god of metal also. It doesn't have to be. All words for, not all words, but you know what I'm saying. Pluralis majestatis, the plural form for, even for earthly leaders is plural. Even for today, for the Ba'alei Mis'ada, the management of the restaurant is still in the plural because it's an authoritative form. So a plural form here, it might really be plural, but it might just be divine. And I don't know. I was asking this question last night, rather late.
But so your translation of Ha'elim would be then the possibility of a singular, but it assumes that it's like a statue or a
I'm raising the question. I don't know the answer. We would have to do a study on Elil and see can it mean an image of the one true God, or does it always mean not necessarily images at all? Can it mean other gods too? Of course, it can mean. I'm not saying it can't, but it just occurred to me that there may be more than one possibility here. It might be an iconic, and it may also be anti-polytheistic. They might have both here.
In my translation, it's saying that it's don't turn to the thing; they mean nothing.
Okay. vanities.
Like it can be a lot of things.
Yes, okay. Which translation is it?
This is Czech.
Thank you for checking that for us. And forgive me for that pun. Okay. Let's do verses now, 5 through 5 through 8. Is Tali?
Yeah, well, my Bible is in Hebrew, so I'll
have a Hebrew Bible, how awful.
When you offer the Lord a peace offering, so offer it that you will be pleasing him. It shall not be eaten on the day you offer it. It shall be eaten on the day you offer it and on the next day. If anything remains until the third day, it must be burned with fire. If nevertheless it is eaten on the third day, it is offensive, not acceptable. The one who eats it shall be burdened with his sin, for he has rendered unclean what had been dedicated to the Lord. That person shall be eliminated from among his people.
Yeah. So, it seems like the deal here is, of course, we're talking about a zevach, what gets translated as sacrifice. Is that how you read it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And,
peace offering.
Peace offering, okay. So this is...
I've got a sacrifice of fellowship offerings.
Okay. So, but these are things that one eats. Basically, this is lunch or dinner with meat. Okay, breakfast too. This is anytime you eat, this is...
And if you don't eat meat very often, then you eat it every minute until the second day. Until the end of the second day.
I don't understand. You eat it every minute.
Well, if meat is rare, that you don't have it that often, then you eat it until it's finished. But it must be finished by the second day.
Right, so leftovers are okay, but not leftovers to the third day. I mean, that seems reasonable.
It's very strong, though.
Yeah.
If it's eaten at all on the third day, it's disgusting. I mean, does that mean literally that it's gone off because we don't have a fridge and you've got to get rid of it after 2 days?
Well, there may very well be some health... You know, there may be very well be some health issues here. You are correct. They have no refrigeration. And it might be a good plan to... get things done. And this is not just sacrifice in the sense like it's got to be good enough for God, because it does have to be good enough for God, but this is also what you're eating. You're partaking of the thing.
Right.
So I assume there is some kind of health issue here, but it also, you're supposed to give God the best, and leftovers after 3 days, maybe that no longer qualifies as the best. And it says you have to burn them. I don't think that means you can now eat blackened, you know, Cajun food just after the third day or something like that. You have to get rid of it.
But it's not what you offer to God, it's what you're eating.
But it counts as what you offer to God. That's the point. We think of always a sacrifice being something you give on the thing and it burns up and goes to God. But actually, every meal is considered a sacrifice. And you eat the sacrifice. So the word sacrifice in the Bible basically means family barbecue. I mean, it's manga. Which is a completely, once you understand it, you understand just how central it is. It's not just for the priests or anything like this. It really is something very community-oriented, family-oriented. And every time you eat, you're supposed to recognize this, eat meat in particular.
So what's the punishment for eating on a Saturday?
All right, so this is, there's some controversy here. The word that's used is in the passive, so you read it, will be eliminated, will be cut off. And there are cases in the text where the passive, this kind of passive, either will be cut off or will be put to death, where it's used together with a verb that has to do maybe with stoning or something like that. So in those cases, it sure sounds like there ought to be some kind of, according to the rules, there ought to be some kind of active punishment. However, that's not the way Rabbinic Judaism took this. Almost completely the way through, they took it as passive, because this is what would happen to you by God's will. you would be cut off at some point. So it was not made some kind of capital punishment. And even in the cases where, for example, when the children of Israel are forbidden from coming up on the mountain, it says if you come up, you'll be killed, passive. You are to be stoned. And so the interpretation is the mountain will throw rocks at you if you come up. So, ad kadekach, how do you say that? To the extent that they will avoid some kind of capital punishment on these kind of things, they will basically say God will take care of you, or it'll somehow be taken care of, in the sense that you'll experience your own kind of punishment. You psychologically or physically.
It's not an outside the camp mark on your forehead. This is a secret. Could be a secret thing.
Yes, and we might see more of that if we. One of the things that struck me in this is in verse. If we go back to verse 5, and I don't want to take this too far because there are the verses after this. It says, so when you do one of these, what are peace offerings, fellowship offerings, whatever you call them, when you do one of these sacrifices for the Lord, then it has emphatically, for your acceptance, you're to sacrifice. Lirtzonchem. Now then, afterwards, it says what it means to do it, kind of how you do it. But I want to just focus on the lirtzonchem, for your acceptance, because what this emphasis tells me is that there is a way to try to serve or worship God or sacrifice to Him or go through the process of, worship that's not acceptable. And I thought of this several times, where you've got worship going on, and maybe we arrive, or in another setting someone else arrives, and they've been going through their normal life, which is just has nothing to do with God, has nothing to do with God in their lives or something like this, and they arrive at a worship service and they are happy to take part and it's meaningful, but there's a complete separation between serving God or worshiping God and the rest of life. And there is a specific way in which we are called to worship, and we're told that it only works if you do it that way. If you don't, and here we have specifics on how you don't do it, then we're told that it doesn't work somehow. And this reminded me of some passages in Numbers and also Leviticus. And I think it's worth looking at this a little bit. Can somebody turn to Numbers chapter 15 and verse 29 and keep that, because we have to read also verse 30. And somebody, no, I'll do the one.
15,
29 to 30. Just a second, I need to get my verses. Okay, so can somebody read Numbers 15:29?
For both the native among the Israelites and the alien residing among them, you shall have the same law for anyone who acts in error.
Okay, so these.
This one says shall benefit, which is.
I don't understand. So read yours.
Sorry, I'm just the different translations.
Yeah, but read
shall
it.
Shall benefit. I think you read there. Required to do the same thing.
Yeah. Read the whole verse.
Read the verse.
The native in the nation of Israel and the foreign who lives among you shall benefit by the same law when he errs ignorantly.
Okay. All right. So the same law applies, basically. This is one kind of infraction against the law. It's called shgagah. In Hebrew, it's a mistake. It's an accident. It's often something you didn't realize you did, and then afterwards you realize you did it, and you feel guilty about it, and so you come and offer a sacrifice, okay? It's not voluntary. It's just an accident. And a lot of Leviticus has, the first part of Leviticus has sacrifices that you do for this, and you're forgiven. Now, there's this idea going around that that's basically the only thing that the law is set up to do. And that's false. The law is set up to deal with more than just this kind of infraction. And so I'm going to read to you from just from Leviticus chapter 6. And I want you to pay special attention to the kinds of things that are being forgiven here. Leviticus chapter 6 and verse... Oh, you know what? I don't know the number. In my Hebrew Bible, this is chapter 5 at verse 20, and in the English Bible, it's chapter 6 and verse 1. So this is one of those cases where the numeration differs. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "If anyone sins and commits a breach of faith against the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in a matter of deposit or security, or through robbery, or if he has oppressed his neighbor, or has found something lost and lied about it, swearing falsely, in any of all these things that people do and sin thereby, if he has sinned," I mean, it's clear he's sinned, "if he has sinned and has realized his guilt and will restore what he took by robbery or what he got by oppression or the deposit that was committed to him or the lost thing that he found or anything about which he has sworn falsely, he shall restore it in full and shall add a fifth to it and give it to whom it belongs on the day he realizes his guilt. And he shall bring a ram," and I should read that. "And he shall bring to the priest as his compensation to the Lord a ram without blemish out of the flock or its equivalent for a guilt offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord, and he shall be forgiven for any of the things that one may do and thereby become guilty." Now, these...
Can you repeat the text? Because I haven't got Leviticus 6, 1 there.
You, then you're 5:25.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. The point here is that these are not sins of accident. Oops, I accidentally robbed someone on the street, oppressed my neighbor, found something that was lost and lied about it. Oops, didn't mean to lie. My children sometimes don't mean to lie. These are voluntary, deliberate sins.
Intentional.
Thank you. Intentional sins. Voluntary sins.
Yeah, I volunteer.
Intentional sins. And yet, as long as you admit, as long as you realize your guilt or you feel guilty and you pay it back and you pay a fifth more and then you make the sacrifice and you're really remorseful, you're forgiven. So now we return to Numbers 15, to the verse 30. So we read verse 29, and that was about involuntary infractions, accidents. What does verse 30 say?
"But whoever acts high-handedly, whether a native or an alien, affronts the Lord and shall be cut off from among the people."
So the question is, what does it mean to act with a high hand? Yad Rama. So this is the kind of sin for which sacrifice doesn't work. And you will see translations do things with this, like sin brazenly, like be proud of your sin or something like this.
Defiantly.
Say it again.
Defiantly,
I've got defiantly too. High-handed.
In
Hebrew, was high-handed? Yeah.
Yad Rama. Yad Rama. I suspect, I don't want to go against our noble translators, but I suspect that inside or with the meaning brazen and defiant, what we have here is someone who's just going through the motions of religiosity and making sacrifice where there is actually no remorse. And
there's no sincerity.
There's no intent to repent.
So he's going through emotions.
And it might feel very useful, kind of, to go through the ceremony, to go through the process of doing it. It might be make you feel better, but that it's not the purpose of the ceremony. And what we're told here is it doesn't work. The forgiveness doesn't actually come. Now, whether that means, I assume it means both. You don't feel the forgiveness, and also the forgive because you don't feel it because it actually hasn't been given. And so this is the kind of sin that the law cannot. There's no remedy for it here because you're not actually performing a part of the ceremony, because a part of the ceremony in Leviticus is to feel remorseful, to acknowledge your guilt. And I would suggest that this is also, this isn't just an Old Testament thing. This goes to the New Testament too.
Right.
We can also be completely in step with our ceremonies or liturgy or the words that we say or all the kind of religious things that we do. But if there isn't some kind of sincere remorse about the things we know we have done, if we just continue doing them, we're in the same kind of unforgiven. We haven't enacted or the forgiveness is waiting there. It's potential, but we haven't realized it because
we can't appropriate it.
Appropriate it, good.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the Haftarah a few weeks ago, which was the beginning of Malachi, where it says, Jacob I have loved and Esau I have hated. And we spent a lot of time, at least I was in America at the time, looking at what this is that Esau, why did God hate Esau? In other words, why is he not forgiven? And it's really the bottom line was exactly what you've just said, which is he despises the very things that God has given him. He despises the covenant. He despises his birthright. He despises his parents. He goes off and marries other people. And so on and so on. And it's the same principle.
I have a question, a practical question. Regarding Act 15, we have not to eat meat sacrificed to the idols. And in Israel, we can buy Arab halal. Is it sacrificed to idol? Halal meat or not?
I think so.
It's cheaper. You understand?
I understand. I don't have an answer for you. Maybe we can talk afterwards. Let's go on because I'm keen to more. verses 9 and 10, please. I don't know who's turned. Rachel.
When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time, or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them before the evening. I am the Lord your God.
So I love these verses. I think they're beautiful. Form of humanitarianism that a farmer on his property is not allowed to collect his full harvest because he's supposed to leave it for poor people and migrants, foreigners, people who it's assumed don't have access to the full kind of economy. And of course, this is the background of Ruth. She is a foreigner. She's poor. She's also a widow. She's in the worst possible, Naomi, I guess her mother-in-law is in the worst possible situation. Well, no, she's a foreigner. Okay. So they're in bad situation. And this is the background of what she does there. And of course, in that story, it's even nicer because Boaz tells his harvesters to keep dropping things. Clumsy harvesters. Oops. Here, have another ear of corn. Not they didn't have corn. Don't quote me on that. Yeah. Well, in the King James, they had corn because corn wasn't corn.
It's interesting, though, like the whole bit is a gift from God. So you get this gift and you have to give it back to the Lord before you eat it. And there's a whole moral thing about how much you can use and how much and how you have to provide.
Yeah.
In the whole thing.
It is very...
like whatever you get is from the Lord, and you have to make sure you know that, and plus you have to think about everybody else.
Yeah, it's touching, and it's also, I hope, more than touching.
I wonder if you can extrapolate that from that too, that you shouldn't make your walls so high around your farm that no corners can actually get through to access your grapes.
It
Do I hear a political overtone here?
No.
It definitely challenges too, even just the simple idea that we have that business is business, like, you know.
Oh, and it,
right. Just that, like, that's just good business sense. Like,
yeah.
What you know, you could do something nice for your workers. You could, you know, make it in such a way that is fair for everyone in a way that they would all agree. But I mean, but no one would fault you, you know, for doing what is just good business, which means, you know, not thinking of the others and just getting all your profits. But this is, you know, really just saying
becoming wealthy at someone else's expense.
Yeah, but it's, you know, these people don't even. Like, from a business sense, you know, they haven't earned, they didn't work, they're just gleaning, but God's saying there's a higher principle, you know, than just business, I guess. So.
All right. Let us move forward to verses 11 through 13.
Do not steal, do not lie, do not deceive one another, do not swear falsely by no means, and so profane the name of your God and the Lord. Do not defraud your neighbor or rob him. Do not hold back the wages of a hired man overnight.
So there's a whole bunch of ethical laws here about dishonesty and misappropriation. And you've got, I think, things together that you kind of expect to have together, but very detailed. So if you've got theft and you've got deceit and lying, you've also got this swearing falsely, and I think this is a nice little study. We don't have time to do it in detail, but you know, it says here, don't swear falsely in my name. That is the meaning of the Ten Commandments, where it says do not take the name of the Lord in vain. It has nothing to do with saying, pronouncing Yud Heh Vav Heh, or saying "Oh my God," or something like this. It really is taking the name of the Lord in a vow or in a promise that you don't plan to keep. And this is the parallel passage for that here. There are other possible passages that say don't misuse the name of the Lord, but that's not those ones. But it's interesting to point out that there are places. I'll give you the numbers. We don't turn there. Deuteronomy 6:13 and Deuteronomy 10:20, where the children of Israelite are actually told, "Swear by my name." So you've got this thing where God says, "I don't want you to swear by someone else's name. I want you to swear by my name. But if you swear by my name, make sure that you do what you say. Otherwise," it's the second part of the verse, "or you will profane the name of your Lord. You will dishonor the name of your Lord." Now, of course, in the New Testament, in Matthew 5, in the so-called antitheses of the law, which are nothing of the sort, because Jesus is not against the law at all. He's against what people have misinterpreted the law. He is very much for the law. And I happen to think he is very much in the spirit of the law, not even going beyond the law. But someone might argue on the basis of what he says about these verses, Matthew 5:33-37, where he says, you know, "You have heard it said," and he quotes this verse, our verse here, "but I tell you, don't swear by," and then he gives a list of things not to swear by. And one of the things to note, he never says, "Don't swear by the Lord's name," because that was not going to happen anyway. Nobody was doing that. You couldn't say the Lord's name already then. So he doesn't say that, but he says, "by heaven and by Jerusalem and by all kinds of things." And he ends up saying, "just let your yes be yes." Now, I don't see that as going beyond the law anyway, because the point of the law was you were supposed to let your yes be yes. That is the thing. And Jesus is not, I don't think he's really going on it. He is, however, very much in line with rabbis of his day, teachers of his day, in the sense that you're not going to say Yud Hei Vav Hei, you're not going to pronounce the name. And it could be seen as kind of building a hedge around Torah to make sure that you don't actually break the thing in Torah, then you don't get near it. You can't swear falsely with Lord's name if you don't swear at all. However, it's not merely that. It's not merely trying to keep to the letter of the law, because the whole point, again, is to say, to do what you said you were going to do, and to not say what you don't plan to do. Yes. And I think honesty is, there's some kind of policy about honesty being best. Let us go to verse 14. No.
You shall not go to the deaf or put a stumbling block before the blind, but you shall fear the, your God. I am the Lord.
So what's the lekach? What's the moral here? What's the... Yeah, okay.
You can't do one thing and the other.
That would seem to, don't take advantage of someone else's weakness seems to be I'm trying to this person is standing in the queue or the line and he doesn't see me, so I get in front and I get an advantage. I think that's included here. Although the specific kind of case is you say something out loud bad about a deaf person, they're never going to know.
But the blind person who's got something in front of them,
but they're not going to know it was you. These are people who cannot, they cannot, not that they should, but they cannot take vengeance. They cannot even get recompense from you because they won't know that you did it. And there's nothing... I mean, just think about it. Okay, we all grew up in nice homes and have been taught to, you know, be nice to people and blah, blah, blah. But if we think about it, just on a very basic level with no morals, I'm more likely to be kind to someone who might take vengeance on me. If Nick knows I did something to him, and he's taller than I am, you know, younger than I am, so I might, you know, but a blind person or a deaf person, a blind person whom I make fall into a hole, or a deaf person whom I curse, they're not going to know. So I think part of this is about, it is about being kind to people and not taking advantage of people. I think that's certainly included. But there's, and this goes with the second part of the verse, there's also an issue here that... you can get away with a lot. You can get away with secret sins. You can get away with committing things that people will never know. And what the text says here is actually somebody does know. Of course, you know, and you might feel very guilty about it. And some people do feel guilty about what they've done in secret. And some people are just fine with what they've done in secret. They have no remorse at all. But there's a principle here. It's the second part of the verse says, but you will fear God. Because even if they don't know, even if nobody knows your secret, it is known.
Is it really implied in secret? Because I was thinking of it on a more... I hate to use the word, a more sort of spiritual understanding. Don't curse out the deaf. They may actually be hearing the Lord more than you know. And blind people, I don't know, can see a vision of heaven that most of us are blind to. I remember there was a deaf man preaching or speaking here a few months, years ago, I don't remember. And I remember going to him afterwards and saying to him, you hear the Lord. He did it through translation. And whatever he was saying, I don't remember. And I remember saying to him, you may be deaf, but you're hearing the Lord more than any of us. And I just wonder whether there's not an element of that here. I'm not saying that you're not right.
That's good. No, I appreciate that a lot. I think it is an extrapolation, but I think it's certainly a worthwhile consideration.
This is the foundation of the difference between a shame-based society and a guilt-based society,
yeah.
A conscious-based society. Okay. And where you get Judeo-Christian civilization. If you don't have people, a society that's based on there being a consciousness of right and wrong, where even if nobody's going to see you, you still decide to do what's right, and conversely, you only do things because you might be shamed. That's a very dog-eat-dog world.
Yes. Which exists today in lots of places.
In big swaths of the world, and those societies don't advance very far.
Yeah. And our societies also, when we
start to break down into that.
Yeah.
So which are we, Danny?
Well, the Judeo-Christian world is traditionally been this. We were
introspective conscience.
Yeah, we were taught to listen to our conscience.
So that's a guilt-based society. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rather than shame. I'll tell you. You go if somebody asks you the way. I'll just tell you the way, even though it's completely wrong. You go straight up and turn left, whereas actually it's behind you. But I would be shamed if I told you that I didn't really know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what we're saying? Yeah.
Is the revering your God because those are my rules, or because that deaf, blind person is part of me, God?
No, I don't see it either way. I see it as you have to fear God. He's the one who knows.
The rules.
Yeah.
I mean, he knows the secret sins.
That's how I took it. Maybe.
Like the blind person didn't see whatever he saw, and you'll have to answer to him.
Okay, I'm eager to get to the next section. Forgive me for rushing. I would like the next person to read, that's you, Amos, right? Verses 15 all the way till the end of 18.
You must not deal unjustly.
You want to share? You want to read two and you read two?
No.
Oh, you don't want to read. Okay, read.
You must not deal unjustly in judgment. You must neither show partiality to the poor nor honor the rich. You must judge your fellow citizen fairly. You must not go about as a slanderer among your people. You must not stand idly by when your neighbor's life is at stake. I am the Lord. You must not hate your brother in your heart. You must surely reprove your fellow citizen so that you not incur sin on account of him. You must not take revenge or bear a grudge against the children of your people, but you must love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord.
Yeah, so you have a whole bunch of kind of rules here about treating other people in justice, in fairness, impartiality, not talking about them, slandering them, and if you want another verse for parallel verse for 19:16, just write down Exodus 23:1. It doesn't have the same words, but it's basically the same kind of ideas. But of course, I'm eager to get to verses 17 and 18. And if we return to Matthew chapter 5 and Jesus, 5:43 and 44 and following, he says, you have heard it said, you will love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you to love your enemy. And that is often thought of as going beyond the Torah. And what I would like to try to convince you of this morning is that no, this is what the Torah means. So if you look at verse 17 and 18, the first thing to realize is the two verses go together. The two verses go together, but I want to say something else. You will not hate your brother, so someone else. It's not just your immediate brother, anybody else, in your heart. So that's someone who's wronged you, someone who's done something that you don't like. It says to reprove them. You're supposed to approach them. You're supposed to talk about it. You are not supposed to just store up a grudge, which is how I understand, and you will not bear sin because of them, or however the end of that verse 17 is. I think those parts go together. And then the thought continues. You will not take vengeance, and you will not either bear a grudge, if that's what it means, elliptically, or another word, possibly, you will not just be furious with someone of your people. And okay, immediately people think, oh, this is just for fellow Israelites. No, because in the next portion, which I will not talk about, it talks about also foreigners, and they're included in this too. So, you know, scratch that off your interpretation. And then it says, "Ve'ahavta le'echa kamocha ani Adonai," but you will love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So the important thing here is the but. But you will love your neighbor as yourself. Because what that, taking these two sentences together and taking them, now I know in Hebrew there's no but there, there's no aval or ach or anything like that, it's just ve. Okay, but ve in Hebrew is polysemous, it can mean lots of things, and you just have to understand it in its context, that here it's a conjunction that is, what's the word?
Coordinate.
Well, coordinates, but it's yeah, it creates an antithesis. It creates opposites. So, because we've been talking about all these people that you would, they've done something wrong to you, and you would be prone to take vengeance or have a grudge, or you need to reprove them, and if you don't reprove them, you're gonna be angry all the time at them. So, what kind of people are those? What kind of term could we use to just?
Enemies.
Yeah, we could call them enemies. They're your daily enemies. The people on a daily basis who just drive you crazy because they do bad things to you. And the text says you're supposed to love them like you love yourself. Or you're supposed to love them because they're like you, or however you want to take it as an adverb or an ad nominal, the kamocha. So
what is Jesus referencing? Jesus has said, Yeshua has said, he's not going beyond the law. He's actually repeating this. What was the reference you gave us?
Matthew 5:43 and 44.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
So when Jesus says, "I tell you to love your enemies," it's not an innovation. It's this. It's exactly this. In fact, it says, "Don't hate your brother." But this brother, this one you might want to hate. The only kind of brother you want to hate is the one who's your enemy. And that's what's going on here. So I think that's a very powerful and very difficult thing to do. I think it's perhaps impossible without some kind of spiritual help. But that's the... I think this is the center of the Torah right here. This is... Not that you don't need to read the rest, okay? It's not like you get here and just get to stop, but... Come back for next one next week.
He does sometimes. He tells the story of the Good Samaritan there, right? And here it says, "Don't hate your fellow Israelite." So,
but that's next week. That's Nick has to talk about. I would love to, but Nick's taller than I am, and so on. after this wonderful, wonderful passage is just so full and convicting and just makes us think about how we're living and if we're really doing it, then we get two sections that frankly to me are just anticlimactic. I apologize to God, to you, but for saying that. We get these passages about kilayim. Now there's a whole tractate in the Mishnah and there's a whole part of the Talmud that deals with this. I'm not saying you ought to go read them in detail or anything, but we tend to see these as saying, oh, silly things. Or maybe we don't see them as silly things. Maybe we see them as very serious things, but I suspect you do see them as a little bit mysterious. So you've got the issue of not interbreeding species, of not planting your fields with two kinds of seeds, and of not wearing clothes that are made of different materials. Now, let me give you in Deuteronomy 22:9-11, you have another list that's also three things. It's also fields, animals, and clothing. The fields, it actually gives a reason for. It says because if you dedicate part of your crop and you mix them, then you have to dedicate the entire crop. That sounds like a pretty logical way to explain it. The animals, it's not about interbreeding, it's about plowing. I tend to see this as not wanting to hurt the animal or have them go in a circle or something, but I don't know much about plowing. And the clothing is specific. It says flax and wool. Now, in terms of explanations, there have been... first of all, I don't think they all go together in the sense that they might not all have the same reason here. It seems that they're connected because they have some kind of mixture, and the mixture is seen for some reason as not being appropriate, but it need not be the same reason every time. It might just be a thematic thing. This thing is mixed, this thing is mixed, this thing is mixed, so I'm going to put them together in my passage here. They have been explained as Canaanite practices. Maybe the Canaanites did these kind of things, and so the Israelites are told not to do them. In terms of the animals plowing, that could be a cruelty to animals thing. It might just be the legislator here has, for this, remember, this concept of holiness, it's not for everybody, it's for this one group of people. And there's just some kind of higher standard, and maybe we can't appreciate why one is higher than the other. Regarding the sha'atnez, the mixing of materials, Chazal, which is rabbinic, the rabbis, they have an explanation, and this is part of their whole tractate on this, is that you won't find this in the text, by the way. This is not in the text, although I've gone and looked for it, and I can see how someone would come up with it, but it's not actually in the text, is the idea that the priest's clothing and tzitzit are shapnez. They are made of two. They can be, or even in the Kabbalah, they're supposed to be, made of wool and flax. And so that would be an explanation why you can't use them on your daily basis for your daily clothes, because they are specific to the priestly garments and to tzitziot, to tassels. It's not in the text, but that is the rabbi's way of getting of explaining this situation. It is a rather for me, still, I mean, it's a rather opaque passage. The last passage, and I will need to finish because it's almost time for church to start, is about a slave girl who is whom a man sleeps with, or sleeps with a man. This is not considered adultery, even though she has been designated by her master to marry somebody. And she doesn't sleep with that person, she sleeps with somebody else. It's not deemed adultery because she's not married. This is certainly protection of the master's monetary financial interest, because he, of course, received compensation for her when he tells her. I do want to point out, though, that if you have a civilization, a culture established where slavery is a part of it, now I think in the Bible there's plenty of ammunition to use to say that slavery is a bad thing and should have been done away with where it has been and should still be done away with where it is. But in a culture where it exists, it's actually very dangerous to release a slave with no means of support. A slave or a second or third wife. Freedom sounds great unless you have no means of support. And so in this particular situation, and we can see this, you can look it up in Exodus 22:15, which is a parallel. It's assumed that the man who slept with this girl, he takes her on now. He doesn't just get to use her and leave her, and now she can't be married off because she's no longer a virgin, and he's responsible for her now. He has to pay a compensation. He also has to sacrifice. It's not considered just completely morally upright. It's not considered adultery, so the death penalty doesn't apply. But there is a concern here in a society where slavery is practiced to make sure that there is a humanitarian point to this. I need to finish. I will not read to you from Isaiah chapter 4, verse 3 to the end of that, which is only like 6 verses. I'll let you see that on your own. I do thank you for listening and for your participation. I hope it was as enjoyable for you as it was for me, and I wish you the rest of your day. Shabbat Shalom.